It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. From books like The End of Men to statistics that tell us there are more educated women in the workforce than men, it's tempting to think women might be doing more than catching up. They might be running the show.
But our guest today says statistics and impressions like that mask the truth about what's going on out there. And in fact, women are earning less, struggling harder, and achieving less than their male counterparts today.
Our next guest teaches journalism at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University.
Carol Rivers is the co-author with Rosalind Barnett of the book The New Soft War on Women. Carol, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here. By the way, I'm at Boston University, by the way. My co-author is at Brandeis.
I see. Okay. Sorry about that. Boston University. Well, It seems like we're at a pretty confused place about where women are right now. On the one hand, you've got the book The End of Men, proclaiming the ascendance of women and the decline of men. But then on the other hand, you've got someone like Anne-Marie Slaughter writing about how the truth is women can't have it all. She gave up a high-powered job in Washington. So why all the confusion? Where are we really?
Well, I think The End of Men was really nonsense. It's true that women are earning more advanced degrees than men, but it's the opposite picture in the workplace. In fact, women are stalling out. In the last few years, while men gained 800 jobs after having a tough time in the economic crisis, women lost close to 300,000 jobs. And that women are fast disappearing from boardrooms and executive suites. And the CEO of the think tank Catalyst says if this trend line represented a patient's pulse, she'd be dead. And the truth is that women are fast becoming the real losers in the economy, and all this stuff about the end of men is just that there's really no statistics to back it up.
So what changed then? It seemed as though we were making some advances, you know, especially in the 80s and 90s in terms of wage equality. We are hearing that greater numbers of women are getting advanced degrees than men. That would seem to indicate that women should be doing okay. So what happened?
Well, what seems to be happening from new research is that gender discrimination hasn't vanished, but it's gone underground. You don't have that sort of in-your-face discrimination anymore, but the old ideas about gender and what women can or can't do are just as strong as ever. In fact, they're gaining in strength, except we often don't recognize it, and that makes it more dangerous.
So, but we've got all these educated, assumingly motivated women out there in the workforce. So you're saying they aren't climbing to the status, these heights of pay and leadership that we might expect because there is under-the-radar gender discrimination?
Yes, lots of it. And, in fact, it's a surprise, I think, to a lot of people who'd assume that all these women in the pipeline, there's a lot of them in the pipeline, they get to certain points along the way and they just get stalled out. They don't move because they're facing issues that men just simply don't face. For example, when men and women work in teams, there's new research that shows men automatically get the credit. That even if women did all the work, knew all the stuff, and the man was just peripheral, again and again women told us, you know, I was the one who did the work, and when we went to report, they all talked to the guys, and the guys got the credit, and the guys got the promotion, and he went ahead and I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, how do you counter something like that? Because if it's just sort of something that's happening organically, what can a woman do?
Well, I think the one thing that's really clear is that women have to speak up and take credit. You know, if you've been working on a team and you did all the work and you see that the guy's getting the credit, you really have to go to the board, your superiors, your boss, and whoever, and say, look, you know, this is what I did. And I need to get the credit for this because it's not fair that somebody who didn't do the work is getting the credit. But women sometimes are reluctant. They think it's bragging. They think they shouldn't do that. But it's really clear that it's essential that women have to speak up because when men and women walk through the door, the men get the advantage of the male stereotype. He's forceful. He's hard driving. And a woman walks through the door, there's the female stereotype. She's passive, she's not so aggressive, she can't lead, and those things really are still very deep in our culture.
You know, but I'm imagining doing that, you know, and saying, really, this was all my idea, and I know this just as well as, you know, the other guy here, and, you know, you could be seen as power-hungry or grabby there instead. I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Ex- Exactly. In fact, there is a lot of research showing that when men are forceful and they're successful, they're viewed as competent and as good leaders. When women are forceful, they are viewed as being bossy and not being liked. And in fact, it's one of the things that Sheryl Sandberg, who wrote the book Lean In, who's the CEO of Facebook, says is that, you know, I've heard this, I've heard I'm bossy, I've heard I'm, you know, I'm just know too much, I shouldn't talk so much. And she says that this is a huge issue for women when they start to make progress, that men are just viewed very differently in this arena.
I mean, what's so hard about what you're describing is that you're talking about behaviors that are really difficult to pull off sometimes for women and maybe for anybody. I mean, in Sheryl Sandberg's book, she sort of said that women were doing their own damage. They were holding themselves back, and that sort of seems to blame the women themselves. I mean, do you buy that line of thinking?
In some cases, they do. I think that sometimes women just feel that it's too risky to speak up and be seen as, you know, not likable, and it's pretty painful when people don't like you. But if you've got the choice between risking being disliked but getting what your due is, and or being quiet, and really there's a big danger of getting passed over because you will be, you probably have to take the risk of speaking up. But this is a problem that men simply don't have. So there's a lot of cases where women just have obstacles to climb that men don't. It's not so much that men are standing up there saying, oh, you women, you can't do it, you know, you shouldn't be here. It's that all these things that we sort of have in our heads are influencing our decisions. And women, as often as men, have these things. Women are just as likely as men to dislike a woman who's successful.
What do you make about that?
I think that's because we have this idea that women are supposed to be nice and women are supposed to be caring. And that's a prescription that if you seem to violate that by achieving and being successful, there's something wrong. That skews our way of the way things should be. But it's a real problem for women.
Now, you're talking about, you know, the ways that women can try to get back in the game and try to fight for what is their due. And, you know, in a summary, maybe it's Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, but, you know, couldn't you argue that, you know, instead of women leaning in, we should be leaning on the men instead and then making other people in society accountable for holding women back?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is true that Sheryl Sandberg does say that, too. She talked about a case where a Facebook woman got a review as being too aggressive, but the manager, instead of just passing this on, went back to the people who gave that feedback and said, sort of point blank, if this was a man, would you have said this person was too aggressive? And they said, you know, we wouldn't. So I think that we really need to get, you know, light on this. We have to get people to understand, hey, this is how you're thinking. You know, subconsciously, you're not trying to discriminate, but realize this stuff is out there, and the only way we're going to change it if we talk about it and think about it and try and sort of work together to find ways to change it.
You know, one thing that feminists today are trying to do is to prove that, you know, women's issues aren't really women's issues. They're men's issues. They're family issues. They're for everybody. How would you say that the problems you're describing and the stalling out of women in the workplace are affecting men and families?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things we see is that when women's wages go down, when women don't move up and they get stuck, what often happens is that their spouses or partners are also harmed because, you know, it's not a great economy and men's wages have also been stagnant and declining. So if a man finds his wife is, you know, not bringing in as much as she could have, that affects his. He may, you know, the whole family may slip out of the middle class, And that's a real problem. And we also know that men today want to do more childcare. But if there's no programs, if there's no paternity leave, no flexibility, none of that, then it's hard for both sexes to, you know, to be good workers and to also be good parents. So I think it is true that these childcare issues are both men's and women's issues. It's not just a woman's issue.
We're talking right now to Carol Rivers, a professor of journalism at Boston University and the co-author of The New Soft War on Women. And we'll be back with her in just a bit.
And we want to hear from you right now. Are we telling your story at the workplace here? Do you think women's progress at work and in the arena of social equality, do you think those have stalled? And if so, why? And do you have a solution? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll be getting your calls in just a minute. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back now with Carol Rivers. She's a professor of journalism at Boston University and co-author of The New Soft War on Women. And we're taking your calls now. Is this something you see in your own life? Has women's progress stalled out? And if so, why do you think that is? Have you seen in your own life some of the instances that Carol was talking about earlier? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or let us know what you think on our Facebook page. And let's go to the phones right now and take David in Wausau. Hi, David.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to give a quick perspective from my wife, who's not home right now, but she's a manager at a larger regional bank in central Wisconsin. And in fact, she's never described this as being a problem. She herself is a manager. The lower level managers, there's a couple that are underneath her, so to speak, and a couple that are above her. She has no men that are managers. So her operations there, and it's a very large operation, there's no men in management. It's all women. So I just wanted to say from her own perspective, she said this is never a problem because her industry, at least her company, is dominated by women.
Interesting. All right. Thank you for calling in with that, David. And Carol, I'm hearing a little bit echoes of Hannah Rosen, who's saying women succeed in these higher level positions better than men because they have more emotional intelligence. I don't know if that's the case at David's wife's bank, but what do you think about a situation like that?
There's really no evidence that women have better emotional intelligence than men. All the research, when you look at it, just says that both men and women are very equal in that arena. Sure, some women are better and some men are more, but it's just simply hogwash that women have this wonderful ability to communicate that men don't have. It's not true. And it's interesting that there's if you're in an arena where everybody's a manager, then you certainly don't have as much of this gender issues. But one thing is emerging that's kind of interesting, and that is there's something called the glass escalator. And we're now seeing that in female dominated industries, when a man does come into that industry, he's promoted faster and goes up the ladder quicker than women do, which is kind of a surprise.
And that's because he's seen as special, or how would you, what would you attribute that to?
He's seen as special, he's seen as more capacity for leadership, and it's really strange because the people in many cases who are promoting the men faster are women. So there's a case where, you know, women are looking at this guy and they're seeing something better than they may be seeing as the woman who's the candidate for the same job.
Where are women's wages right now, and where are they as compared to their male counterparts? We've said it's stalled out, but do you have a sense of what those numbers are?
Yeah, I do. I do have some numbers. In fact, we haven't moved much since JFK signed the Equal Pay Act back in the 1960s, and you see that, for example, over a lifetime of work, women with a bachelor's degree will earn a third less, $700,000, than a man with the same degree. Female MBAs earn nearly $5,000 less than male MBAs in their first job. And again, another study showing that 2 years out of school, a man will be making with the same degree and the same number of hours worked in the same field, the man will be working, will be getting $9,000 more than the woman. So there's tons of evidence showing that the wage gap is really a big problem and it's not moving.
Can we legislate it away?
Well, I think, you know, we certainly can try. There is legislation, and sometimes it gets stalled out for, you know, equal pay for equal work, but it takes a long time. Look at the Lilly Ledbetter case, which finally the woman who sued because she was paid so much less, it took her something like 9 years before the legislation was actually passed. So we're not looking as hard as we should at that, and we really need to.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Samantha joining us from Argyle. Hey, Samantha.
Hi there.
What do you think?
Hi.
On your show, thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I don't know if this is as much applicable, but I've noticed in my own field, I'm a dairy farmer, and typically, when I was in school to become a dairy farmer, the population of women, although it's coming up in this occupation, is relatively small. And I found the first year I was married to my husband, on my taxes, it automatically went to farm wife as opposed to dairy farmer. And my husband's occupation says dairy farmer. So I found it to be, well, I don't know, a little bit disturbing when even the government is looking at me with quite a different perspective than I guess I had envisioned for my career.
Yeah, that's
yeah. Some of those old ideas, you know, it used to be that if you were a woman, you couldn't get a credit card in your own name; it had to be in your husband's name. And a lot of those things are gone, but some of them still hang around and pop up when you least expect them.
How interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Samantha, and thank you for calling. And on to Tessa in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Tessa.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Great.
I'm a truck driver. I've been a truck driver for almost 20 years now. And when I first started, I never saw any other women out here, you know, that were solo drivers. But there's getting to be more out here. It's very nice. But my husband's a roofer. And in the off season, he'll come with me, you know, on the road. And no matter where we go, any warehouse, any receiving department, I'll say, hey, watch this. And we'll walk in together, and I'm holding the bills and the paperwork, and they go right to him. Mm-hmm. Every single time, they'll go right to him. And he'll chuckle and say, no, no, I'm a roofer. She's the driver. But it's just the perception even now, you know, that people, oh, you drive that big truck. Well, yeah, the truck doesn't realize I'm a woman, so it's cool.
Well, you know, and that's the exact example of the idea that when the man walks in the door, if people see him in one way, and a woman walks in the door, even if she's holding the bills and says, I'm the truck driver, they view her in another way, and they think, no, it's the guy that's doing it.
Okay, well, Tessa, thank you so much for calling with that. It's an interesting experience you're having there. And, Carol, what do we need to do as a society to get the needle moving on women's progress again, closing the wage gap and all that stuff?
Well, I think there's we have to be sort of go at three levels. At the first level, women have to realize that these sort of underground things are holding them back, and they have to speak up, even if it's risky. They have to, you know, make sure that people know what they're worth, and they have to not sort of hold themselves back and say, oh, gee, can I really do that because I'm a woman? And they see men doing it, they think, oh, that's for guys. So I think if women are aware these things are out there, that'll help. But we also clearly need federal policies, and we certainly need, you know, family policies. We're so far behind the rest of the world, don't have any kind of decent maternity leave, paternity leave. We're like, you know, everywhere else in the developed world, there's a really good system of child care, so that when fathers and mothers are working, as most do, they're not frantic all the time about who's going to be there to pick up the kids. And certainly this would make a huge difference if we had these changes in policies for both men and women.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted.
We've been talking to Carol Rivers, a professor of journalism at Boston University, co-author of the book The New Soft War on Women with Rosalind Barnett.
Thank you, by the way, to everyone who contributed during our fall membership drive. More than 6,300 listeners pledged, including 1,600 sustaining pledges, and we're pleased to welcome 1,300 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. Check this out. You donated over $811,000 to fund Wisconsin Public Radio and the programs you depend on. Not bad, eh?
Coming up, a look at donations to Supreme Court candidates and how those candidates vote when their donors come before them in court. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to the scientist who led the effort to sequence the human genome and create the first synthetic cell.
First, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism published a report showing a correlation between campaign donations by attorneys to Wisconsin Supreme Court justices and rulings that favorably affect those same attorneys.
Jake Harper is with us. He's the author of the report. He's a Madison-based freelance reporter. Jake, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how common is it for attorneys to give donations to Supreme Court justice candidates?
Well, I'm not sure how common it is for attorneys across the state to give to Supreme Court justices, but a large percentage of the individual contributions to Supreme Court justices are from attorneys. Mm-hmm. In terms of attorneys who appeared before the Supreme Court, there are a large number of cases that have attorneys who have contributed to justices.
So your study wasn't making the case, I don't think, that the money given by attorneys sways justices, but you look for some correlations. What kind of things did you find?
Well, across the board, we found that attorneys who had given to the Supreme Court before about 60% of the time received a favorable ruling from the justice that they contributed to. That varies by justice a little bit, but that was the average that we found. And that by far the largest recipient of that money was Chief Justice Shirley Abramson.
And how did her votes go when compared to those donations from attorneys?
I think her rulings correlated about 58% of the time, and that actually went up. With larger donations, she was more likely to vote in favor of those attorneys. Again, we're not talking about causation. This is just correlation.
And why did you track just attorneys? A lot of other groups spend money, maybe not donating directly to candidates, but in outside expenditures. Why this focus on attorneys in particular?
This was a story that occurred to me, I guess, back during Justice Rogan's sex election earlier this year. It was sort of a direction we decided to go. We felt that it was an issue that hadn't been covered before. And a lot of stories do deal with the clients or these independent expenditure groups, but we wanted to look into the attorneys specifically.
So you mentioned Justice Abramson. What did we find about the other justices that you looked at?
The numbers will come to me after this interview probably, but all of the justices ruled with their attorney donors more than 50% of the time, except for Justice Michael Gableman, who ruled exactly half the time. And he had a fairly small number of cases. It was just 4 cases total. And then Justice Crooks also was not included in the study because he was not required to file a electronic campaign finance report.
So part of your story was tracking these correlations, and part of it was getting the reaction to them. And this comes after years of an ongoing debate about when should Supreme Court justices recuse themselves from cases. In getting reaction from people, what was the sense you were getting as far as whether these numbers point toward maybe a need for more rules on recusals?
Well, I think one thing that a lot of people pointed out was that this could have to do with attorneys contributing to justices that they agree with, so that the correlation in that sense would make sense if an attorney is giving to a justice that they think will think in the same way that they do in terms of the legal issue that's before the court. I think the other issue that came up was the public perception of whether justice can be bought, in a sense, by people who contribute to Justice's campaigns.
And is there a movement to either end attorney donations to Supreme Court justices or have more of a system to say, here's when you should recuse yourself, here's when you shouldn't?
I'm not aware of any law that deals specifically with attorney contributions, but attorneys are often lumped into this category, parties that appear before the court. And there are several laws on the books or, I guess, pending before state legislatures across the country.
Now, in your story, you talked to some advocates for reforming either the campaign contributions or the way justices deal with their donors. Did they see this as ammo for their argument, these correlations you found?
I think the general sense of what I took out of it was that this can't help the public perception of the court. I don't think I talked to anyone that said that this was definitely something that they would cite often when they're talking about these issues, but they said that any sort of correlation that contributes to this public perception that a justice is not impartial is potentially bad news for the Supreme Court.
And did you talk to any of the donors to get their reaction to this?
I was able to speak with one donor on the phone, and I attempted to contact others and did not hear back.
What was the reaction from the one donor?
It was not great, as people who have read the report might have seen this, but he did not seem happy that I was asking about these contributions, and he basically said that there was no correlation between the decisions that he got.
And then did you try to get a reaction from any of the justices or spokespeople for them?
I reached out to all seven of the Supreme Court justices. In the end, I only spoke with Justice Patrick Crooks and Justice Patience Rogensack, and I received an email response from the Chief Justice, but she did not respond to a request for an interview.
And Justice Rogensack made an argument that I think she's made elsewhere during her last campaign, in fact, that it's not that the donations cause the vote, it's that people make donations to judges they feel will represent them in a certain way.
Yeah, and she also made another point about a proposal that came before the court in past years as well, was that basically there was this proposal in 2008 from the League of Women Voters asking that the court force recusal when they've received a $1,000 contribution. And she basically said that attorneys or anyone who might appear before the court could use that rule to basically get justices off the bench. They could donate $1,000 and remove justices that they don't like from the bench and keep them from ruling.
And how did the campaign finance advocates respond to that?
I think one of them talked about an alligator coming out of his ear and how unlikely that was. That was Jay Heck of Common Cause. And I think the general sense that was that if something like that were to happen, then there would then be a rule put in place to prevent that.
So the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, over the years, they've had some image issues, to put it mildly. Is this just a kind of another straw on the camel's back, hurting people's perception of the court?
I think the report is too new to really be able to tell that. As you said, there are a number of issues that sort of color the image of the court, of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So I think it remains to be seen whether this report will do anything to affect that.
And are you going to follow this up with anything else along a similar vein?
We've got a number of stories, I guess, to look into. I think there are other possibilities with this data that I've collected and I'm going to look in and see what else might be there.
All right. Well, Jake, thanks so much for joining us and sharing this information.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Jake Harper. He's a Madison-based freelance journalist, and his report on donations to Supreme Court justices is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
What exactly is life? It's a question for the ages, and one that became a lot more complicated in 2010 when a team of scientists created the first synthetic cell. It was life born out of not other life, but of science.
The leader of that team, J. Craig Venter, sequenced the genome a decade before anyone thought it was possible. He's here with us now to recount that pioneering effort and share what genomics may have in store for the future.
His new book is called Life at the Speed of Light, From the Double Helix to the Dawn of Digital Life. And Craig, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Nice to be with you.
Well, you begin your book with three words. What is life? Do you have an answer?
Well, we're much closer to an answer than Schrödinger was in 1944 when he wrote his book called What is Life? And he approached it as a physicist, just seeing if life obeyed the laws of physical principles, which he concluded that it did. We know from the history of the last 70 years, first, that DNA was the genetic material. In 1944, they thought it was proteins. We learned the structure of DNA from Watson and Crick. We learned how to interpret the genetic code and how it coded for proteins. Then in the 1970s, the first sequences. In 1995, my team sequenced the first genome of a living organism, and that was decoding all its genetic information and putting that in the computer. And 5 years after that, we did the first version of the human genome that I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about. And I call that digitizing life, where we convert the DNA code of A, C's, G's, and T's into the ones and zeros of the computer world. And now we have shown that by going the other way, we can start with the computer code and regenerate the DNA, starting with four bottles of chemicals, and build the chromosomes and then boot up new life with that synthetic DNA. And that's what we reported in 2010. And the book describes this journey for the last 70 years of the history of DNA and how we've been able to read the genetic code and how we've learned to write it. And we've learned that life is a DNA software system.
It's pretty mind-blowing when you talk about it and you describe it that way. The idea of, you know, booting up life, that's not terminology that you usually think of as sharing the same real estate. You're using computer terminology and the terminology of biology at the same time. Does this represent a watershed moment in our human history?
It could, in terms of the biological worlds and the digital worlds of the computer have been getting closer and closer together. We can't interpret the biological world without the help of massive computers. And now we can interchange the information from DNA to the computers and back again. So I think it represents a unique transition in our history because the implications of having DNA in the digital world and being able to recapitulate life from it, the implications are pretty vast.
Well, people have imagined the creation of artificial life from Frankenstein on out. You were the first to do it. What was that initial cell like? What made it life?
Well, in fact, it was a long, arduous task of our team working for years, and the book describes a lot of the pitfalls and blind alleys and how research really works and that it is hard work to get there. But it's a cell that once it was alive, it's self-replicating and has divided billions of times, making copies of itself and metabolizes energy using sugar as its energy source like we do. But it was really a proof of principle that all this was possible, and now we're trying to design a totally unique life in the computer that will help us understand what are the absolute necessary components that distinguish life from non-life.
This is pretty heavy and heady stuff for the average person. What are some of the practical applications that could affect everybody?
Well, the first things that we're doing with it are trying to come up with a very rapid way to respond to new emerging infections. And so we've been working with BARDA and the U.S. government and the Novartis vaccine company to come up with a way using our tools to very rapidly make new flu vaccines. And we've been able to shorten the time from months down to less than 12 hours simply by taking the digital code out of the computer and rewriting new genetic code to code for the vaccine form of the virus. This has the implications that we could actually send a new vaccine around the world in less than 1 second. And so if you have one of these decoder boxes, you would be able, eventually even in your own home, to be able to download the latest vaccine, which could totally prevent future pandemics.
But if you have the code for it, don't you also need the actual stuff, that this, the building blocks of life as well, besides just the code?
Well, the boxes that we're making, that we have the prototype of now, you'll simply add cartridges to that like you do your computer printer. Instead of having ink cartridges, you'll have chemical cartridges that have the four letters of the genetic code that gets put together in the right way depending on the signal that comes in.
So you're building that now?
We have the first prototype machine already. It's funded in part by DARPA and the rest by the synthetic genomics company that I'm the head of.
Well, that's incredible. In a world where we're worried about global pandemics, that's something a lot of people would be pretty interested in, I bet.
Well, if we can help get rid of future ones, we think that would be the first good practical application of this new technology.
What about using some of these new forms of life you're talking about, you know, for food? Is that something else you're looking at?
So we are trying to use this new set of tools for fuel, for food, for new medicines. And so for food, we're trying to code algae cells to produce very highly nutritious proteins and produce them about 10 times more efficiently than any current agriculture system can. So as we go from 7 billion to 10 billion people, we're going to need pretty dramatic new sources of food and fuel to not wipe out all the resources on the planet. So a lot of those advances we think will come from this exciting new field of synthetic life, synthetic biology.
Is it going to be necessary to have conversations a lot like the one we're having, but on a broader scale, with people who are just, you know, they're a little creeped out by this? Because what you're talking about here is not the natural way that we're used to creating life and building stuff.
Well, it's how life has actually been being built for the last 3.5 billion years, and we're just starting to understand that process now. And by understanding that, we can hopefully move it a lot faster. But yes, we consider, and I consider, that public education and having these conversations is an essential part of science. I think all scientists have the obligation, whether they have public money or private money, to explain what they're doing on a broad public scale, because if we don't bring the public along with us, it's going to make the next stages much harder, even if there's something that could be a life-saving technology. If people don't understand it, they'll react against it. And a recent survey has shown that over 50% of people don't realize that tomatoes and all other plants and animals are DNA-based organisms. And so if that's the level of understanding we have, it makes the conversations a lot more difficult, but show that they're much more important to have to make sure we're all speaking the same language.
Now, the technology you're talking about, and you're talking about, you know, for instance, sending the code for a vaccine around the world in a minute or even less time than that, how do you protect that? Because in the wrong hands, you can see that this would be something you might have to be pretty worried about.
Well, it is an important aspect of this, and we've spent a lot of time working on with ethical review and even security review on this technology. And the Sloan Foundation funded my institute along with MIT several years ago to look at the security and risk aspects of this. And, you know, it is something that is being constantly looked at. The conclusion was there are so many other ways, including going to almost any farm in the country to get anthrax, that somebody wanting to do harm doesn't have to resort to try and design a new complicated synthetic organism, which takes a highly sophisticated science to even contemplate doing it. And I think it would be extremely hard to do. So, but, you know, the security aspects are very important to us. And the instruments that we're building will have multiple layers of security, so they can't even be used by people who are not authorized. So I think we're trying to think of as many aspects of this and working with government officials and others to ensure that what we see is orders of magnitude greater potential for good, but with any new technology, it always has the risk of abuse by individuals, so we're trying to minimize that risk.
We've only got about 30 seconds left for your answer here, but you know, you said you're less worried about playing God than you are about the possibility of not using this technology. Why is that your greater fear?
Well, when we look at how we're depleting the resources of this planet, changing our atmosphere, so we're changing our weather, as we're constantly increasing the population, we're going to increase the risk of new emerging infections and multiple social and economic problems if we don't have good sources, clean, renewable sources of food and fuel and medicines. I think our technology will be a part of the solution.
All right. Well, Dr. Venter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice talking with you.
We've been talking to J. Craig Venter. He sequenced the human genome and led the team that created the first synthetic cell. He's the author of the book Life at the Speed of Light.